The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on November 4, 2018. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Well, happy Central Standard Time Day. This isn't as difficult a day, I think, for most people as daylight savings time, where you have to, as a college instructor once said about daylight savings time, where you set your clock forward. His way to remember that was, spring forward, son of a bitch. And he wanted us to remember that because we had a concert on that day, and he didn't want, performing a concert, and he didn't want any of us to be late an hour. So this one, I guess the worst that would happen is you'd be somewhere early an hour. I know when I woke up this morning, which is still somewhat early, I was up at 6, and it was dark, and I thought that I actually got up at the wrong time. So I went around to all the clocks in my house to verify that I indeed was getting up at the right time in the morning. Because I was thinking, well, it's now it's what was 7 o'clock last week, so it would be nice and sunny, but no, it was rainy. That was why it was dark. But I'm not here to talk about standard time, believe it or not. I'm going to give a talk today called How Do You Live? And going over the talk, I realized that there's a potential flavor to that title that's like, how do you live with yourself, which I did not intend at all. So this is just the question, how do you live? And it's intended really to just be a question to encourage us to pay attention to how it is that we live, not to come up with an answer or a bunch of answers or to write an essay or anything like that, but just to pay attention. And this talk is actually inspired by a talk that I gave last week. I was invited by somebody who comes to Dharma Field to give a brief 10-minute talk at her church on right livelihood. And 10 minutes is not a lot of time. So while I was preparing that talk, I realized there was plenty to say about right livelihood that I could develop it into a talk that I could give at Dharma Field. So that's what this is. It's a talk on right livelihood. And right livelihood is one of the core teachings of the Buddha Dharma. And I say that because it's one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, as you may know, is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. And that is one of the first, if not the first, teaching of the Buddha was the Four Noble Truths. Pretty much every other teaching that you will hear in the Buddha Dharma, that Buddha instructors will offer, they come from the Four Noble Truths. You can always link that back to the Four Noble Truths. So right livelihood, this is one of the core teachings of the Buddha Dharma. Before I talk about right livelihood, I really want to talk about the Eightfold Path. I'm not going to talk about the Four Noble Truths because if I didn't have enough time in 10 minutes to talk about right livelihood, I'm not going to have enough time in a half hour to talk about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and then finally get to the right livelihood. But that Eightfold Path, I at least wanted to talk about path. Those of you who come to Dharma Field have probably heard this before, and you've probably heard this from me before, but I think it bears repeating, and that is that path is the way of the awakened. But think of it this way. The way we normally would think of a path is that it takes us someplace. That we start from one place and then we take a path and we go someplace else. And I suppose if you're thinking of the Eightfold Path and the way of the awakened, that the way you might think of that then is you start from, I don't know, darkness or confusion, and then you walk along the path, and then you are enlightened. I don't know if that's the way you think of it, but that it becomes a way to get to enlightenment. But really, the path is just in a way what we step on in this practice. So we don't go anywhere. Just being on this path is to fully take up this practice. To be awake is to be on this path. Or to be on this path is to be awake. That's it. That's what the Eightfold Path is. So I just want to remind you that. It's just our practice. It's just taking up what the Buddha Dharma is. I called it the way of the awakened. I also make sure that people understand that when we talk about the way, we're not talking about this is the one right way and all other ways are a problem. This is the way. Instead, this is the way in that this is the way of living here, taking up life. That's the way. So that's our Eightfold Path. It's just to take up this practice, and this practice is to fully engage in life. And that's really what it is. Now, right livelihood, conventionally, when it's spoken about, we're talking about how one makes one's living. And I'm just going to say that's conventionally how it's talked about. I'm also going to speak about it a little more unconventionally toward the end of my talk. How we make our living. Before I get into that, into details about that, I want to talk about that word right. Again, this is something that I know you've heard me talk about if you've heard me talk before, but it's important to note when we're talking about right livelihood, this right is not the usual way we understand the word right. When we hear right, I think the automatic impulse for those of us at least not familiar with these teachings, those of us who are familiar with these teachings, we've heard a teaching like I'm about to give, but we'll hear this in dualistic terms. Right livelihood. Oh, so that must be as opposed to wrong livelihood. But this right is not right as opposed to wrong. This right, rather, is in accordance with the whole. That's it. So it's not about good or bad, or right or wrong. It's just about living in accordance with the whole, living in accordance with, I would say, life as it's unfolding. So that means that right livelihood, the teaching of right livelihood, isn't to be seen as a teaching that offers lists of jobs that are good jobs and jobs that are bad jobs. Because it's not about good or bad. Saying that, I will tell you that there are some traditional teachings that do have lists of types of professions that are not right livelihood. I'm actually not going to talk about those traditional teachings today. And I'm not going to do that, actually, because they are teachings that can be easily grasped. In other words, they give you a list of types of professions that are not right livelihood, and we so easily then grab that and see these as kinds of rules. Ah, this is something I should not be doing then. This is not going to be right livelihood. And they become not supple. Then we get into those problems where we start looking at what we're doing and we get caught up and going, oh, is this one of those five categories that I shouldn't be engaged in? Uh-oh. You know, and then you exert a lot of mental effort and there's some anguish in there trying to figure out whether or not this meets the rules or doesn't meet the rules. It's not that the teachings are actually doing that. Again, it's just our tendency to take a teaching like that and turn it into a rule, grab onto it, and then wrestle with that. And I think when I had been looking at those teachings, one of the reasons we can so easily do that is that those teachings, in a way, are generalizations. They're really just meant to be provisional pointers to, hey, take a look at how you're making a living. Ultimately, those teachings, in spite of what they look like, ultimately, those teachings are designed to encourage us or to remind us to be mindful in how we live. And that's it. So that's why I'm not going to offer those traditional teachings, because it's just going to give you a list of stuff, and then you start going, oh, okay, I know. And what comes along with that, too, is judgment of people who might be engaged in those professions. Oh, well, you are doing this. That's not right livelihood. And that, again, is not the spirit of these teachings. These teachings are to encourage us to be mindful. But how are you taking up your life? How do you live? Now, I say that, and that doesn't mean that we can't think of ways to make a living that we might understand just at a first glance probably aren't very helpful. They're probably harmful professions, harmful ways of making a living. I call them professions right there, but they're not necessarily, they don't have to be a profession, just a way you make a living. So we can think of ways that are harmful. Perhaps if you're a mercenary, or if you're engaged in human trafficking, it's easy to see that as being harmful. So in saying that there's not a list of jobs that are good and bad, I'm not saying that we can't immediately see ways of making a living that are harmful. But this is where that suppleness that I'm talking about is important. Because even in those situations, even in those circumstances, there are conditions in which those kinds of ways of making a living arise, in which they may seem to be or may even be a necessity. So even then it becomes difficult to categorize and say, oh, that's wrong. Again, we're in that right-wrong, right? So that's not right livelihood, but you can hear in there the right-wrong. And what I'm going to do, just to give you an example of this, is something that came up in a discussion group here on Thursday mornings. We have a study group. It came up, and I'd actually been thinking about this example when I was going to talk about right livelihood last week. So it was interesting to me that it came up again in a completely different context. But it's from a book by Thich Nhat Hanh called Being Peace. That's probably one of my favorite Thich Nhat Hanh books. I think there's much wisdom in that book. And Thich Nhat Hanh tells a very briefly, I don't know that he tells a story as much as he just recounts piracy in the area, region around Vietnam, and how, as you may recall, after the war, there were refugees from Vietnam that got on boats, and then pirates would come in. This part you may not have known of, but pirates would come in and loot and rape and pillage the boats, people on the boats. And Thich Nhat Hanh was talking about that, the pirate. He talked about a story. His practice community would get letters from people who had suffered greatly from the effects of war. And one letter they got was about a young woman who had been harmed from a sea pirate. And this is what Thich Nhat Hanh wrote about that. He said, when you first learn of something like that, you get angry at the pirate. You naturally take the side of the girl. As you look more deeply, you will see it differently. If you take the side of the little girl, then it is easy. You only have to take a gun and shoot the pirate. But we can't do that. In my meditation, I saw that if I had been born in the village of the pirate and raised in the same conditions as he was, I would now be the pirate. There is a great likelihood that I would have become a pirate. I can't condemn myself so easily. In my meditation, I saw that many babies are born along the Gulf of Siam, hundreds every day. And if we educators, social workers, politicians, and others do not do something about the situation, in 25 years, a number of them will become sea pirates. That is certain. If you or I were born today in those fishing villages, we might become sea pirates in 25 years. If you take a gun and shoot the pirate, you shoot all of us, because all of us are to some extent responsible for this state of affairs. And that seems to me to be a very compassionate and deep teaching. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh is not letting the pirate off the hook. We might look at that and say, well, okay, so he's excusing that pirate's behavior. That's not what Thich Nhat Hanh is helping us to see. But rather, he's helping us to see that our understanding of situations, the way we immediately rush to judgment, the way we immediately read that situation, then condemn somebody and perhaps execute somebody based on how we've framed the situation up, does not reflect the entirety of the situation. It does not reflect the whole of reality. It's an unwholesome way of seeing, and then we would act out of that. It misses the interconnectedness of beings, the inextricable interconnectedness of all beings. To break that pirate out, to separate him, to blame him and condemn him without seeing the entire situation. It's not to see that interconnectedness. And it's that interconnectedness that makes right livelihood, seeing right livelihood, whether or not what you're doing is right livelihood or not, it's what makes it difficult. It's what makes it difficult to discern, at least from the standpoint of, is this kind of job I should be doing or a kind of job that I shouldn't be doing. Globalism, I think, helps us to see interconnectedness. We live in a global community. And I think that when you are participating in this, it becomes very easy to see how interconnected everything is. So, for example, if you know somebody, and I'm not saying I do, but I do, but I'm not saying that I do. If you know somebody who will only buy an American car, what does that mean, an American car? As we can start taking that apart, in fact, I saw some project, I think it was an art project. It sounded like, it looked like something an artist would do anyhow. And they took apart, it was a car engine, and they just labeled where everything was, where the, I think just the materials that went into making the thing, where they were from in the world. And it was all over the world. So where does your rubber come from? Where does your steel come from? And that's just looking at that material aspect. Then who turned that material into what is in your car? Where did that take place? Where did then that motor get assembled? Where did your car get assembled? Where did it come from? And then it has that Ford label on it, right after all of that. So globalism at least helps us to see that. If we stop and look, we start to see that it's not so easy anymore. But really all that's doing is helping us to see a truth that is always already there. There is this interconnectedness. What we do right now, what we do in every moment, is part of the conditions that foster, for example, livelihoods around the world. Everything that we do is part of that. Everything is interconnected. And so that helps us to see a slightly more subtle way of thinking of interconnectedness. Is the way we tend to see the world, the way we tend to think of how our actions work in the world, is in terms of cause and effect. Because it looks like that. It looks like this causes that. But interconnectedness helps us to see that actually that we think of as the effect is actually, and I'm just going to use the word contained. I couldn't come up with a better way when I was putting my notes together to say this, but that, what we'd think of as the effect, The thing that we think of as being outside of us is actually contained in this. Right here, we would think of as what it is we're doing. So that cause and effect come together. They arise together. And so when we're thinking again about right livelihood, we're thinking in a way about the whole. We're thinking about how this will show up as that. How what it is we're doing right now affects the whole. And with that in mind, I think you can see that again, just coming up with a list of good jobs and bad jobs, to put it like in a very crude way, that's not actually very helpful anyhow. Because we can see that ways of making a living, and granted, again, I said there are some that we can see are harmful, but most professions, most ways of making a living, it's a little more difficult. And we can understand that they can actually be helpful or harmful depending on how they're taken up, depending on what it is you're doing when you take up that way of living. So for example, in Richfield, where I live, there was a housing development that was going to go up. And it, as a lot of housing developments are, especially in Richfield, I know, there's a percentage of the housing project, so it was a big apartment complex, that was going to be affordable housing. And all I know is there was a controversy, and I had a friend who was at the heart of that controversy, because he said that suddenly the percentage of affordable housing was tripled by the developer. And he had statistics showing that that kind of density of affordable housing is actually counterproductive. They actually can be harmful. And his argument was, and this is, I'm not saying this was true, I'm just saying this was his argument, was the developer could get funding from the state for providing the kind of affordable housing he was. So all I'm really saying is whether or not my friend's analysis is exactly true in that situation, here you have housing or property development where we can provide housing that's affordable for everyone, and that sounds great, and then you can take that and turn it into something that's not so great. Just based on how it is that you're taking this up. Are you trying to cash in? Or are you trying to provide genuine help to the community? Where I was speaking to a friend once who was a nurse. She still is a nurse. And she told me that she started suspecting that the place she worked was engaged in fraud. And so she didn't know what to do. Here she is, a nurse, works in oncology. So the field where we need compassionate people, like my friend. And what does she do? What is her next step? And we can see that there's no easy answer to that. We can see how we could remain in that field and try to transform it, at least in that job, or leave. And neither one of them are blameworthy. We could just stay in the job and just do our job and keep our head down. But how are you going to do it? How are you going to live? And there's a job that's nursing, oncology. And depending on how you take that job up, it could be harmful or helpful. Again, we start to see how then a list of right livelihood on this side and wrong livelihood on that side, it just doesn't do it. It's too crude. Instead, we need to look at how are we taking up our lives. And we can also think that professions can be helpful or harmful depending on when you take them up. That everything has a condition or a circumstance in which it's useful. And then there are moments when it ceases to be useful. And I came up with a silly example. They don't have to be silly. But I just thought about firefighting, which is a pretty helpful thing. We want firefighters. If we have a fire, we want them to put that out. But we could imagine the actions of a firefighter. We don't want some guy axing down your front door and dousing it with water if there's not a fire. So you can see that taking up some activity, taking up a way of living or taking up your work has circumstances in which it can be harmful and helpful as well. So when we are taking up our way of living, when we are engaged with life, the question is, I think, you think about the company that was engaged in supervising the nurses, or you think about the property development, are we taking care of ourselves when we engage in this practice, or are we taking care of others? Are we taking care of ourselves, or are we taking care of others? And in the Buddha Dharma, there are two different ways of thinking of self, two different ways that we can point to self. One is that usual way we think of self. What I'm saying, are we taking care of ourselves? That's what we're usually thinking from and thinking of, which is me, whatever your name is, Steve, Liz, Mike. You start there, and then you go, now is this going to make me happy? Is this going to make me rich? Is this going to make me satisfied in some way? That is what we refer to at Dharma Field as small s self. And that's an idea that we have. We have this experience. That's life. And then out of that, we create this kind of a character. Because it seems like, to us, well, it's actually because of our tendency to need to explain what is taking place in a way where we say, well, there's this experience, but there has to be somebody having that experience. So then we put that self in there. We think we see that self. That small as self. So that's what we usually think of when we're talking about taking care of ourselves. But when we take care of that self, taking care of small s self, that's taking care of no one, if you think about it. Because you're not taking care of others in that case, at least you're not thinking of it. You're just thinking of taking care of that small s self. But as our teachings point out, if you actually look for that small s self, that explanation we have about what's taking place, we realize we can't really find it. If we just sit with our experience right now and pay attention, we start to see that what seems to be a compelling story, that there is an individual that's here, wherever here is, and there's a world out there that we're experiencing, you start to see that self, it's hard to locate. If we were to tell somebody what you meant, if you told somebody about, yeah, well, I know who I am, and you had to actually explain that, if you've ever tried doing it, you know it's impossible. And it's impossible because it's really this vague idea we have that we think has some solidity to it. So in a way, when we're taking care of that self, we're taking care of no one. Taking care of others, on the other hand, is taking care of self. That's that big S self. That is reality. That's totality. That's actually taking care of the whole situation rather than having an idea about it and acting out of that idea about it. And in the case of self, that idea would be that small s self. Taking care of others, then we take care of ourselves. And again, you can see that in a conventional way, even if you think in conventional terms of others and self. When you take care of others, your life becomes, it's taken care of. You feel that and you see that. Shunryu Suzuki talks about when he was living in Japan during the war, he was a monk, and he grew a garden to feed himself. And the neighbors came and they helped them create the garden and take care of it. And they would share food with him. Actually, what happened was somebody went to his pantry and he opened up his rice bin and they found out it was empty. So they gave him rice. Why did they give him rice? Because he was open and sharing with what he already had. So they gave him rice, and he said when people found out he had rice, then people would come around to get rice from him. So he would get rice, he would share rice with people, and then sharing rice with people, he'd get more rice. So in taking care of others again, he's being taken care of. Now we might say, sometimes you got to take care of yourself before you can take care of others. But if that's truly what we're talking about, what you'll see actually is you're still taking care of others. The example I thought of is, you know, when you're on a jet and they have those little cartoons that you look at that tell you what to do in case of an emergency. Now, if you're at all panicked about flying, all of this stuff does nothing but just sort of fuel the fire a little bit as you start to imagine scenarios in which you're going to need to have an oxygen mask. But at least what I'm talking about is that oxygen mask. Because they always tell you, put the oxygen mask on first before you take care of others. So you can look at that and think, oh, see there, it's telling you take care of yourself before you take care of others. But if you look at it, again, not in that limited perspective, you actually see it's telling you to take care of the entire situation. You're still taking care of others. You're not going to take care of others for very long if you're passing out. Right? So to take care of that whole situation, put the oxygen mask on. So again, we're still taking care of others in that. It's a wider picture. It's the whole picture. So when we're talking about right livelihood then, we're talking about engaging in a way of making a living, of making a life that is paying attention to the whole situation. And that sounds mystical, it sounds big, it's like, oh, I gotta know all that. No, you don't. You just have to really always be thinking, whatever it is that you do, about what's showing up, and do what is best for the whole thing that's showing up. Just do the best you can as you see it. Trust your own heart. This is an important teaching in the Buddha Dharma. Buddha Dharma, the way that people might take those five types of professions that aren't right livelihood is to then take that as a teaching. But Buddha Dharma isn't offered that way. Remember the Buddha's teaching to his disciples when the Buddha was sick, he knew he was going to die, his followers were heartbroken, and even fearful about what the future would be like without the Buddha. Remember his teaching. Be a light unto yourself. Betake yourselves to no external refuge. Hold fast to the truth. Look not for refuge to anyone besides yourself. So when you're taking up your livelihood, you don't need somebody to tell you. If in your heart you feel this is wrong, if you feel there's something harmful that's a result of, or that is a part of what it is you're doing, then I would say there's no answer for what you do next. But be aware of that and do something. Do something. Attend to that. Cause no harm. That's the bumper sticker I see whenever I pull into my garage. We have it actually affixed to our garage. Cause no harm. So that's one thing to ask ourselves as we're trusting our heart. Is what I'm doing, does it harm others? I said I wasn't going to tell you about the Four Noble Truths, but here I am at the First Noble Truth, right? Dukkha. There's suffering in this world. We don't need to add to it. There's suffering in this world. Take care of that suffering. Tend to it. So is what you're doing, does this harm others? And along similar lines, ask yourself, how much do I need? And that's along similar lines, because how much do I need gets to that question again of, are you taking care of self or others when you're engaged in the way you live? How are you going through your life? How much do you need? What do you need? These are questions to ask, especially in this culture where we seem to get so much stuff. I mean, I'm happy I have a friend who gives me gifts every holiday season, but we were just noticing that we haven't used the last three. They're still sitting there, and I would like to use them, but I don't really need them. Now, granted, I wasn't purchasing them myself, but I'll go ahead and buy stuff I don't need. I know I keep talking about books, but that's just because I see them all the time in my house. So whenever I buy a book, I go, why did I buy that book? I'll say my husband set a really great example. I was at a record store, and I also don't need any more CDs in my house. And I went, oh, there's a new CD by, let's see, who did I buy a CD by? It doesn't matter. So anyhow, but I got my little stack of CDs, and I noticed that I was planning on my husband buying the remainder of them. So I thought, well, I'll get these three, and I know he's going to get those other two. And he didn't have anything. And I said, "But aren't you going to get the Grant Parker CD?" And he said, "No." "Well, how about Richard Thompson?" "No." "Well, why not?" He said, "I figure we should probably get rid of some CDs before I buy any new ones." But there you go. How much do you need? How much do we just keep adding to our lives and not even aware of it? So that when you get to a certain point in your life and you want to get rid of all that stuff, suddenly you go, oh no, why do we still have this? So how much do you need? What do you need? So I think you can start to see from what I've been saying so far that when we're talking about livelihood, that we normally think of how do we make a living, that question isn't really necessarily about making money. It's about how do we live? How do we live our lives? So when I was a teacher at a community college, the thing about a community college is they're great institutions. They provide access for many people to be able to take a step into higher learning. But there's a story, it's a cultural story. It's one you'll hear in America that the reason you go to college is to get a better job so you can, I don't know, move up the social ladder. I don't know it's put that way. It's usually just you go to college so that you can get a better job. That certainly was the convention that I grew up in. I went to college, and I remember telling somebody once that I was a music major, which I was. And the guy said, well, what corporation are you going to work at with a music major? I mean, it was just his immediate question. And so I would try to tell my students, there's more to life than your job. Right? Life is going to be more than that. In fact, your job is just, it's your life in that it's what it is you're undertaking. But it's really how you go about living that's important. But of course, I was a freshman composition teacher, so that kind of went in one ear and out the other. But I would try to get them to see that. And so one day I was listening to Minnesota Public Radio, and there was this really great documentary about two students of color, and they might have actually been Hispanic students, I can't remember. But they were students for whom the odds that they were going to go to college were already low, and that they were going to finish college were even lower. And both the students said that had they known that the odds were so stacked against them, they probably would have dropped out. But they didn't know. They did know that it was difficult, and that they had a more difficult time because they had to work jobs while they were going to school. They had a more difficult time than a lot of their peers were having. That they understood. And they also said the main reason they were going to college was to get a better job. And that was why their family wanted them to go to college. But what was interesting to me was that they finished their college degree, and then the interviewer said, well, are you making more money now than when you went to college? And there was this pause, and both of them said, no, I'm not. And both of them said, but I totally thought going to college was worthwhile. because I know so much more than I thought I was ever going to learn. I know so much now. And you know that they're just going to keep taking life up now with a slightly different, I don't know, I don't even think it's necessarily what they learned in college so much as it was doing that, that their life has got a different flavor to it. They're going to be okay. They're going to be okay. But they learned the thing I was trying to show my students that I think you can't show somebody, that you can only experience, which is that it's not the stuff we're going toward that matters. It's how we take up what we're doing right now. How do you live your lives? So it's not about that goal that turns life into fragments, right? There's now this thing out here and I'm here and I got to go to that. But rather, just every step of the way, how do you take this up? And that's what I heard in those students. That's what I heard. The spirit in the way they were living was they just took up going to college and they struggled with it, yes, but they just kept doing it. It was their life. It was what they wanted to do. It's that taking up life in that way. That was what they are now. I would say it's what they gained, but that's not even the right way to put it. That's the practice of living that they took up, that they are now still taking up. So when we're talking about right livelihood then, are we living out of that small self or big self? Are we living out of taking care of just life as it's showing up? Or do we take care of some ideas we have about success or some direction we're going to be going? Do we, in taking up our lives, do we fully engage with what shows up in life? Whether it's difficult or not difficult, do we fully show up? Or do we try to resist what's going on based on ideas we have about the way it should be going? I mean, that's very easy to do. I have these ideas, and we don't even know we have them necessarily about the way the world should be going. For me, all you got to do is get me in a car and get me behind a steering wheel, and you're going to hear about some ideas I have about how the world should be going, and it rarely goes that way. But we carry that around with us all the time. So when we're engaging with life, are we fully engaging with it? Are we trying to push away that stuff that doesn't match the way we want it to be? Do we try to manipulate life so that it turns out the way we want it to be? And I'm not even saying don't do things that are going to, I don't know, you want to go on a vacation so you put in some overtime to make some money. I'm not saying don't do that. But I'm just saying, again, how do you live? You don't have to answer that. Again, it's not an essay question. It's really just, how are you living? What are you doing? How are you taking care of your life? And when I ask, do we fully engage with what's showing up? A related question that comes up with that is, do we even see what's showing up? Do we even see what's showing up? That's another question to ask ourselves. Because again, we have ideas about the world, and something will show up, and we interpret what's going on through those ideas. And we don't even see what's actually taking place. So we can't fully engage with what's showing up until we can actually see what's showing up. And our practice is to wake up to what's showing up. It's to be aware of what's showing up. In Buddhism, Plain and Simple, Steve tells us a story about the time the Buddha was asked to sum up his teaching in one word. One word. That seems like quite a task. And he summed up his teaching in one word. Awareness. And that's what my whole talk is pointing toward. Right livelihood is to be aware of how it is that we're taking up our life and to live out of that awareness, to really see what's taking place and to live out of that rather than out of ideas that we have. So it seems to me this teaching of right livelihood isn't just about what kind of job you have or what kind of profession. It's about how you take up your life. It's about how you live each moment. And so then we can see how it truly is a core teaching of the Buddha Dharma. I talked longer than I thought I would. So this was a 10-minute talk I just gave. So I'll end my comments, and I'll invite any questions or comments you might have. Mike, do you have a...
Well, I was just going to say, you know, when you were talking about getting an education to get a better job, you know, I kind of fell into that, but on one hand. But on the other hand, I always thought that education was valuable in and of itself, that it had intrinsic value, that, you know, and I happen to be fairly good at math and, you know, where the job prospects were good. Didn't work out that way when I first quit college, but eventually it did. But yeah, no, I think education is valuable for its own sake. It's innate value.
Yeah, look, having that goal to say improve one's lot. So I'm assuming, you know, I look at my family and what my stepdad did for a living. He was a... I wish I could remember the full title. The only part of it I remember is the thing he did, you know, is the actual activity he did. But he was something winder, like a generation, generator winder, something like that. And I know that generator was probably part of it, because what a generator winder, or whatever this winder job was, what his job was, is in generators. There are spools, at least there were when he was working on spools of copper wire, and that was his job. He wound copper wire around and around and around and around and around, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, sometimes longer if he had required overtime, and that's what he did. And so when I was going to college, partly it was, I don't want to be a generator winder or whatever it is. I did want something else for myself. And I did see it as, you know, a better job. Because he got paid crap to do that as well. So not only was it horrible work, but then it was not the greatest living in the world. But he had been in high school when World War II happened. And so Pearl Harbor, he was 17 years old. He went, I want to go fight in the war. I want to defend my country. So he never finished his high school diploma. He was a very smart guy. But that's the kind of job he had, was the kind of job that was available to him. So yeah, I was kind of going there to do that. But it wasn't solely why I was in college. I understood that I was there to learn. And I took that learning very seriously. That's unlike a lot of habits that I was seeing in students, where it was the goal that mattered. So getting the degree is all that mattered. So what is the minimum amount of work I have to do in this class to get a C, because I need to take this class so that I can get my degree, so I can get my better job. And all that was being vacated. The life right there that they were living was being emptied to that goal. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. I mean, I certainly didn't want to poo-poo or eschew the idea of going to college to get a better job than, say, one's parents or just one, what one thinks one's prospects might be. But that's not the end all of it. That's just an idea we have. And in the meantime, here we are now in college. So, yeah, taking up that education. But education or not, whatever it is, it's do we do it for that end goal, or do we do it just take care of what's taking place here, and that end goal will take care of itself. You know, do the best you can. That's what I always tell my students when they would say, I don't understand why I'm not getting an A on this paper. What do you want? And I would say, I want you to do the best you can. That's all you really can do. The best you can. That's it. That's all you can do. But it's what you can do. And I didn't see a lot of that. And so it became very hard even for me to be able to evaluate their writings. Matt, what were you going to say?
This bright and lively conversation comes up. The anecdote that I was then reminded of is I had a buddy who, after college, he went to Alaska for AmeriCorps. He worked in the Forest Service in Alaska for a summer. And then he just fell in love with Alaska. And so he wanted stay there. And the way that he found to be able to stay in Alaska and afford to live there and also make enough money to pay off his student debts, which were pretty extensive because he got no help from his family, was to work for an oil company up there. So he would, for 3 weeks, he'd go up north of the Arctic Circle, work 12-hour days every day for 3 weeks, and then 2 weeks off to be an Anchorage or go around Alaska or whatever. And then we had a mutual friend lived back here with me in Minnesota, and he was always so disappointed in our friend for going and working for an oil company in Alaska. Meanwhile, I had to tell a friend, my friend, Justin, man, you drive a car and I drive a car. This friend of ours who's working for an oil company in Alaska doesn't even own a car. So, you know, you work for oil company and it's just biking around everywhere. So really it's like, you know, we're all tangled up in this system of petroleum. There's almost no way around it. But even though he's up there working on the oil fields, he's probably using less energy than we are. So, you know, it's not like a simple black and white thing about, you know, he's doing the bad job working for the oil company. He's just doing what he has to do to get by.
That's absolutely right. I don't even have anything to add to that. That's perfectly stated. You know, so looking at how your life shows up as the person working in the oil rig, for example, but it really is just about taking care of your life again. So one of the things we do when we encounter a teaching like this is to look at what other people are doing and go, shouldn't be doing that. I mean, of all the things you could be doing, why are you doing that? Right? So that's easy to do. A lot harder to maybe look at your car usage. Trying to think of somebody. There was a story about driving, but I have a better example. There's a great French film called Contempt. It's a great film. It does have contempt for its audience a little bit, so if you are going to watch it, just know it's not necessarily the... To me, the humor is great in it, but the humor is meant to be kind of punishing. It's by a filmmaker named Jean-Luc Godard. And he's known for just not being fun. But anyhow, they had an American in the movie. And this is so great. He's an American film producer, played by Jack Palance. And I remember he was going from, we'll say, from here to there. And here to there was probably only about, I don't know, it was like 100 feet or something like that. But he gets in this big red car, uses a giant car, and he peels out, and he literally just like crosses a parking lot. And then he gets out of the car. It took him like 2 seconds to drive where he was going. He drove everywhere because he was an American. But so, yeah, just thinking about our car usage and what are we doing? But thank you for sharing that, because that is the tendency, is to look at how people make a living and then you're doing that. And who knows what your friend was even doing. So, yeah. Any other questions or comments? Hello?
I just, you were talking about Baba, you know, the Buddha saying about be a light unto yourself. So you need to think about what you mean by yourself. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. So I just thought that was kind of...
Right, well, that's exactly right. I think that's a great question.
I really thought about it that way when I started practice. You know, it's more like confirming who I am.
Yeah.
You know, and what I think, that's what counts.
Right.
That's not what he's pointing to.
Right. When you're saying yourself, what is you're talking about? When the Buddha's talking about be a light unto yourself, what is he talking about? There is no external refuge. So when we start thinking in terms of that small s self, then suddenly there are experts we can go to. There are things we can depend upon. And the Buddha's helping us to see that really our freedom is that we're it. You know, I think that can be scary for some people. That we're the arbiter, we're the, you know, it's our heart that we are trusting, because it's, you know, it's just reality is showing up. But right, what is that yourself? That is a great question. So I won't even say much more than that. Any other comments or questions? Well, thank you all.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.